It's the NPR News Update. I'm Phil Picardi with Minnesota's News on your schedule for Tuesday, October 21st. Today on the podcast, the new stadium is already nearly a quarter finished. An in-depth look at the recent agreement between the Twin Cities Archdiocese and a victim's attorney. Farmers are driving bigger equipment and plowing into power poles. And the music of a prolific Minnesota composer. First, First Lady Michelle Obama is campaigning for Democrats in Minnesota today. Obama is appearing at a Minneapolis high school with Governor Mark Dayton and Senator Al Franken. Republicans are using the First Lady's visit to make the case that incumbents are too close to a president with waning approval ratings. The candidates for Minnesota Secretary of State yesterday revisited the voter ID issue at a forum at the University of Minnesota. Tim Pugmire reports.
When Republican Dan Severson ran for Secretary of State 4 years ago, he campaigned on the need for a photo ID requirement to vote. This time, he's pushing for an express lane voting option for Minnesotans who voluntarily show an ID at the polls. Severson said he came up with the idea after voters rejected a photo ID constitutional amendment in 2012.
Minnesota was uncomfortable with a constitutional amendment. I get that. This is another way in which we can secure our system and actually accommodate the voters more effectively.
State Representative Steve Simon, the DFL candidate for Secretary of State, slammed Severson's proposal, calling it a warmed-over version of voter ID. Tim Pugmire, Minnesota Public Radio News.
A federal grand jury has indicted a former engineer at Boston Scientific alleging he stole trade secrets from the medical device company. Peter Cox has more.
The criminal complaint filed in U.S. District Court in Minneapolis says Aaron Q used a thumb drive to download and steal hundreds of documents about the design of three catheter systems, including one that has not yet been patented. The complaint says Q helped develop them while at Boston Scientific's Maple Grove facility. The devices help improve blood flow. The complaint alleges Q planned to start a company which would manufacture a product based on the designs in Vietnam and sell in the U.S. and other countries. He was arraigned earlier this month and charged with 14 criminal counts. He entered a not guilty plea. Peter Cox, Minnesota Public Radio News.
Globe University and the Minnesota School of Business have been put on probation in a U.S. Department of Defense tuition assistance program. Here's Alex Friedrich.
Schools on probation may not receive military tuition benefits for new students, but they can still get benefits for ones currently enrolled. Lieutenant Commander Nathan Christensen, a department spokesman, says the move doesn't affect veterans or GI Bill benefits.
Tuition assistance is for people that are on active duty, that are in the reserves, that are in the National Guard.
A Globe spokeswoman says the department based its probation decision on a recent suit by Minnesota Attorney General Lori Swanson, who claims the schools misled students about their job prospects. The schools insist they did not, and their spokeswoman called the probation decision unnecessary. Alex Friedrich, Minnesota Public Radio News.
The market for Twin Cities office space is getting tighter. Vacancy rates in the Twin Cities office market ticked down in the third quarter of the year. Annie Baxter reports.
Twin Cities office vacancy fell to 14.2% in the third quarter, the lowest vacancy rate since 2006, well before the Great Recession. That's according to the Colliers International Minneapolis-St. Paul office market report. The report says companies increasingly want office space to include areas for employee collaboration as they seek to recruit top talent with attractive workspaces. A few years ago, costs more frequently drove leasing decisions. Colliers expects to see steady office leasing activity through the end of the year. Annie Baxter, Minnesota Public Radio News.
Concrete pillars, steel trusses, and construction cranes have changed and are continuing to reshape the skyline of downtown Minneapolis. Managers of the Viking Stadium project say the building is nearly a quarter of the way complete and remains on track to open for the 2016 football season. Matt Sepik got a tour of the construction site, and he explains what's been done so far.
If you've ever walked through a house while it's under construction, it's usually easy to picture where doors, windows, and plumbing fixtures will go, even if the walls are just a skeleton of 2x4s. But stand on what'll soon be the 50-yard line at a billion-dollar football stadium, and you need someone to explain just exactly what it is you're looking at.
You can see just through the green tower there, says upper concourse. That's the highest level.
That's John Wood, a senior vice president at Mortenson Construction, the project's general contractor. Wood points to a mass of brand new concrete six levels above the east end zone.
The seating, which will be in, above that, that's the highest concourse.
Wood says about $1 million worth of labor and materials go into the project every day, and the progress is obvious. Only 10 months ago, the Vikings played their last game at the Metrodome before it was torn down. Since then, he says workers have poured about 55,000 cubic yards of concrete, about half of what's needed for the project. That's enough to fill 5,500 standard cement trucks. If something's not made of concrete here, chances are it's steel. Like the Metrodome, the new stadium will have a roof, but not one held up with pressurized air. In the dirt on what'll be the playing field sits a zigzagging network of steel I-beams held together with bolts. It looks like something you'd see under a bridge, but Project Superintendent Dave Mansell says it's a section of the main roof truss. He says it weighs 740,000 pounds and won't be on the ground for long.
We'll be setting that mid-November, and that's really what we need that large crane for.
That large crane is one of 13 on site now. Mansell, who also oversaw the construction of Target Field and the Xcel Energy Center, says two more cranes will be on site by March. With all this equipment, temporary structural supports, and scaffolding, the place looks chaotic. But Mansell says it's highly controlled chaos. Every day, he looks at a 3D computer rendering of the project that's linked to the construction schedule. With design software he calls his crystal ball, Mansell can see what the stadium should look like if everything stays on schedule a week, a month, or 6 months from now. This detailed planning means workers can do things on this project they never could do while building a house. Even though the stadium doesn't get its main roof until March, Mansell says drywall crews have already hung sheetrock in parts of the club level that are enclosed.
On a building of this size, you can't wait until you get the roof completely on to start this work, or you'd never get finished. As soon as we open up space, we have all the coordination done and we can come in and start doing the rough ends.
And in case you think Minnesota's winter will mean a slowdown in work, Mansell says think again. Concrete and iron work will continue despite the cold just as long as it's not too windy. Mansell says the number of workers on the site will increase to around 800 in January and more than 1,100 by the spring as the new Vikings Stadium continues to take shape. Matt Sepik, Minnesota Public Radio News, Minneapolis.
In rural Minnesota, collisions between farm machinery and power poles are on the rise. As farm machinery gets bigger and bigger, electric co-ops say they're seeing more incidents of farm equipment striking poles or snagging overhead lines. As Mark Stile reports, the collisions can be dangerous and costly.
Federated Rural Electric in southwest Minnesota once again had to dispatch a repair crew when a farmer got too close to power lines earlier this month. The co-op's marketing and communications manager, Andrea Christopher, says a farmer tilling a field hit a transmission tower.
He did clip the pole, which snapped it.
More than 2,000 Federated customers lost power for a couple of hours. Christopher says it was the third accident the utility's seen just this fall. She says the number of incidents seems to be increasing with the size of farm equipment. She says it's harder to judge distance with a large machinery compared to when equipment was not as wide or high. In an accident last spring, a farmer misjudged the distance to some guy wire stabilizing a nearby power pole.
When he was holding the arms down on the tillage equipment, he thought he was safe and had cleared it, but hadn't. And so then when he moved forward, he did pull it all down.
The casualties included five power poles in all, in nearly a mile of line. And Federated is not the only one seeing a trend. Sioux Valley Energy serves seven counties in southwest Minnesota and eastern South Dakota. Safety coordinator Terry Ebright says his co-op is seeing a couple of incidents a month.
We've got about 20 contacts from farm equipment into our power lines since January 1st of this year.
Ebright says the accidents have caused a lot of damage to the electric system and farm equipment alike. He says it costs a couple $1,000s to replace a power pole. Plus, nearby customers lost electricity in most of the incidents. The accidents can also fry farm machinery that can cost hundreds of thousands of dollars. Ebright remembers one case where the long booms of a herbicide sprayer caught an overhead line. Electricity surged through the machine.
I know it took out about 3-4 tires on the tractor and the sprayer, and burnt up other equipment.
Ebright says so far there haven't been any personal injuries in the accidents, but he worries it's just a matter of time before someone gets seriously hurt. Electrocution is a significant factor in on-farm deaths. About 60 U.S. farmers die each year in electrical accidents, including power line incidents. There's an economic incentive for farmers to maneuver close to electric infrastructure. They want to get as close as possible to power lines in order to keep every bit of land they have in production and generating revenue. Retired Northwest Minnesota farmer Jack Stock says that's the case on his land, farmed mostly now by his sons. They seed a narrow strip of property dotted with power poles on one side and public property on the other. But the equipment they have is actually wider than the strip they own, so they navigate around the poles in a scallop pattern.
You have to do the same thing with our sprayer and diggers and everything that we use around there.
Stock says the family pays close attention to the poles. He says they understand their importance to the area.
We need electricity, there's no question about that.
But besides that and safety concerns, there's another incentive for farmers to be careful around power lines. If they damage the structure, the electric company will bill them for the cost of the repairs, and that cost can easily run into several thousand dollars. Mark Stile, Minnesota Public Radio News, Worthington.
Last week's news conference in St. Paul between Catholic officials and victims attorney Jeff Anderson took a lot of people by surprise. The deal settled one clergy sex abuse lawsuit and led to a child protection plan. It confused people because it was a major reversal for Anderson, who has been one of the church's fiercest critics. The deal was so sensitive that not even all of Anderson's clients knew the details. Madeline Barron reports.
Minnesotans have grown accustomed to hearing Jeff Anderson denounce Catholic officials. He's filed hundreds of lawsuits on his home turf in St. Paul and around the country on behalf of those who've been sexually assaulted by priests. Back in July, outside the Ramsey County Courthouse, Anderson said Archbishop John Nynstedt was just as guilty as any bishop he'd exposed over his decades-long career.
My view is that he and the other top officials that made the conscious choices they did should go to jail for their participation in these crimes and aiding and abetting them. And I believe that until a top hierarch such as Nynstedt hears that jail door clang behind them, they'll continue to do in the future what they've done in the past. That is conceal, deceive, and cover up.
Then, last Monday, Anderson made an abrupt about-face at a news conference with church officials that appeared at times to more closely resemble a prayer service than a settlement announcement.
From all the sorrow and all the pain, we come together today to begin a new day in this new way.
Anderson described the settlement of the lawsuit as something more than a business deal.
In the last 3 to 4 weeks, they've been coming into our office to join hands with us on behalf of the survivors, to acknowledge the pain, and to make sure there are no other kids that are going to be hurt the way so many here and out there have been.
Anderson touted what he called 17 historic child protection protocols, reached in negotiations with the Twin Cities Archdiocese and the Winona Diocese. Most of the protocols had already been church policy for decades, but Anderson did not mention that. Anderson then did something even more surprising. He invited abuse survivors to come forward with the television cameras rolling to shake hands with church officials.
Keep coming. Wow.
After the news conference, when asked about the agreement, Anderson was short on details.
There's nobody, though, that's going to be monitoring whether or not this agreement is followed.
Yeah, us. We are the monitors.
How would you know that files haven't been turned over to you?
Well, one way is I've got a pledge from the Archbishop.
For some survivors of clergy sex abuse, this whole spectacle was difficult to take.
I'm not here for a handshake.
Just days after Anderson's news conference, a man who says he was sexually assaulted as a child by a priest squared off against a lawyer for the Twin Cities Archdiocese in Ramsey County Court. The man and his lawyer are trying to get other priests to say what they knew about his abuser. The man, who asked not to be named, says Anderson's agreement with the Archdiocese and the news conference seemed like grandstanding.
There are survivors that are real victims here. This just isn't, a media sensationalized law firm getting together with an Archdiocese to try to put a cloak over the fact of what really happened all of these years with the Archdiocese.
Abuse survivor Bob Schwederski has known Anderson for more than 20 years. He now leads a support group in the Twin Cities for people who've been sexually assaulted by priests and others.
I left the news conference on Monday downtrodden. I thought it was a dog and pony. There's a lot of survivors that are totally confused right now. What happened to my individual need for healing and recovery and justice?
Underneath all the handshaking and praise lies a complicated legal strategy played out by both sides. In many ways, the Archdiocese continues to have the upper hand in negotiations. Victims' attorneys know that the Archdiocese can file for bankruptcy without warning at any time and bring the entire process to a halt. It's not a theoretical concern. Last year, the Archdiocese met with lawyers who are representing the Archdiocese of Milwaukee in a protracted bankruptcy dispute that's dragged on for more than 3 years. Anderson's law firm represents many of the 575 people in Milwaukee waiting in line for a settlement. The firm has devoted significant financial resources to the fight, but not one of his clients has received a check. Attorney Mike Finnegan, who works with Anderson, says the fear of a Milwaukee situation here motivated his firm to strike the deal.
In Milwaukee, people have died, people are committing suicide, and people are completely beaten down from that process. And all that it's resulted in so far is attorneys, bankruptcy attorneys, getting paid tons of money, millions of dollars, and nothing going to the survivors so far. And that's one of the fears that I've had throughout this.
Finnegan says it's not just about money. Although the details may have been lost amid the media event, the confidential settlement agreement does include a process that could lead to the release of some of the files on priests that are currently under seal. Finnegan says a special master, chosen and paid for by all the parties, will resolve disputes over the sealed files. He says the firm pushed for more files to be released because it believes the Archdiocese's practice of keeping information secret has put children in danger of being abused. The law firm also reached a separate agreement on behalf of all of its clients. That confidential agreement was not disclosed at last week's news conference, and it wasn't disclosed to most of the law firm's clients either until after it was signed. Anderson later described it to NPR News as the agreement behind the agreement. Finnegan says the agreement behind the agreement includes a promise from the Twin Cities Archdiocese and the Winona Diocese to follow the child protection protocols announced last week. Finnegan says that abuse survivors could sue the church for breach of contract if it violates any of the protocols.
This agreement doesn't take away any of their rights. They still all have, you know, if they don't follow through with this, you know, with any of this, we still have the ability on behalf of any of the other survivors to bring their case and fight as aggressively as we have in the past.
University of St. Thomas law professor and canon lawyer Charles Reed says he wasn't surprised by the settlement, given the bankruptcy fears, but he was surprised by how congenial it all seemed. Reed says Anderson's reputation as a tough critic of Ramsey County attorney John Choi for failing to aggressively prosecute church officials could take a hit.
He will not be able to give that criticism with the same level of credibility, because now he's also shown flexibility. What was he criticizing John Choi for not bringing criminal prosecutions? So now he's doing business with someone he thought might want to be criminally prosecuted. There is a slippage of credibility there.
In response, Anderson says he does not think the news conference will take the pressure off the Archdiocese. He says he stands by his decision.
I knew that there would be critics, and I think there should be. And I can't say that I have absolute certainty that it's a new day. And I can't say that I have absolute certainty that it's a new way. We give it a chance to be. And if it turns out to be the same old thing, the same old way, we will have to declare this the best of efforts and a failure.
Anderson says if the cover-up does not end and more kids are abused as a result, he will hold himself responsible. Madeline Barron, Minnesota Public Radio News, St. Paul.
Minnesota composer Stephen Paulus died Sunday. He was 65 years old. Philip Brunel told us about working with Paulus yesterday. Paulus was a prolific composer and a founder of the American Composers Forum, the St. Paul-based organization that nurtures young composers. Dan Olson has this remembrance.
Minneapolis poet Michael Dennis Brown collaborated with Stephen Paulus for nearly 40 years. He recalls hearing the Pilgrim's Hymn melody in an opera he and Paulus collaborated on and knew it had potential.
And when I heard the melody, I said, Stephen, can we bring that back at the end of the opera? May I write new words to this glorious melody? And he hummed and hawed. But he did it and changed the key and doubled up the voices. And that has become our major piece. And in fact caused him to found Paulus Publications.
Stephen Paulus made a good share of his living writing for individuals or groups who wanted a composition. Linda Heschler says she and her husband commissioned Paulus every 5 years to write a piece of music to commemorate their wedding anniversary. Courtship Songs was the first. Heschler, who lives in St. Paul, is a former executive director of the American Composers Forum. She says Paulus's music is accessible, even as he explored new ideas.
He wrote something the singer could sing. He wrote pieces the players could play, yet would hopefully challenge them and challenge the ear.
Stephen Paulus was born in New Jersey in 1949. He was 3 years old when his father moved the family to Minnesota for a job as a chemical engineer at 3M. In a 2000 interview on Minnesota Public Radio, Paulus said his father was a church organist on the side and that their Roseville house was full of instruments.
In addition to, a grand piano, an upright piano, and a trumpet and several other instruments varying from accordion to banjo. We also had an old reed organ in the back room that my father had procured from somebody.
Paulus graduated from McAllister College in 1971, then earned a Ph.D. from the University of Minnesota School of Music. Composer Libby Larson was a fellow grad student. She says both of them were frustrated that only other grad students heard their compositions. Larson says she and Paulus wanted a wider audience to hear and judge their work, and they wanted the pieces to be played on the instruments they were composed for, not just a classroom piano.
We would meet in Shevlin Hall, and it wasn't very long before we said, well, let's just make an organization.
They asked Linda Heschler, then with the Dayton Hudson Foundation, for money. Heschler convinced the foundation to approve $10,000 to create the Minnesota Composers Forum in 1973, now called the American Composers Forum. The St. Paul-based forum is the world's largest service organization for composers and is regarded as one of the premier incubators for new music. Paulus rose to prominence early with Carol of the Hill in 1976. 3 years later, and just out of grad school, Paulus's church opera, The Village Singer, commissioned by the Opera Theater of St. Louis, won favorable reviews. Paulus wrote more than 400 works, including operas, orchestral and choral compositions, as well as arrangements of old tunes like The Road Home, with new words supplied by Michael Dennis Brown.
Tell me where is the road I can call my home, that I left, that I lost so long ago.
Paulus was composer in residence for orchestras in Atlanta, Tucson, Annapolis, and Minneapolis. He won coveted Guggenheim and National Endowment for the Arts Fellowships. Philip Brunel, the founder and artistic director of Minneapolis-based Vocal Essence, says Paulus's compositions have a worldwide following.
I've heard them in Europe, I've heard them in South America, that people know Stephen's work, and then also, of course, his operas, because he was the first American to have an opera performed at the Edinburgh Festival.
Stephen Paulus was also a businessman with his own music publishing house. Paulus was an influential voice in the wider music world. He was a board member of ASCAP for more than 15 years. ASCAP is the American Society of Composers, Authors, and Publishers, and represents artists' interests in copyrights and royalty payments. Stephen Paulus's Minnesota fans supplied a steady stream of commissions. He composed To Be Certain of the Dawn with Michael Dennis Brown in 2005. The oratorio was commissioned by Father Michael O'Connell, then pastor at the Basilica of St. Mary, as a gift to the Jewish community. It was performed by the Minnesota Orchestra with chorus and soloists. Paulus said the first part is a statement of Christian repentance for the Holocaust, the middle part a memorial to the experience of the Jews, and the final section a vision of reconciliation and cooperation among faiths. Paulus chose to live in St. Paul instead of on either coast. He credited people here for the support that allowed him to flourish as a composer.
The general good spirit of collaboration that exists in this community. There are many, many people who are willing to, you know, quote, take a chance with composers living in the area. They go out on a limb, definitely, you know, in the early stage of a composer's career by volunteering even to do these things.
That's the NPR News Update podcast for Tuesday. I'm Phil Picardi, back with Minnesota's News tomorrow.